Hello everyone, and a very, very warm welcome to the second in our series with our lovely partners, Landor. Today we're focusing on rebound, recovery or recuperation, and we have a real treat in store. When I was speaking to Nick before about this talk, he's so insightful, he's got so much knowledge, and he's a budding historian. I think you'll really enjoy what it's part of. So many of us have been pivoting, reframing and embracing opportunities. And that certainly is true at the Marketing Society. Today marks our 34th webinar since COVID and since lockdown. So it's fair to say, before that we hadn't even tried them. So it's fair to say that we have very much embraced this new way, and it's been a really great opportunity for our business. Now more than ever before, we really feel like a truly globally connected community, and it's wonderful to see so many of you dialing in from all around the world, and we're just going to find out where in just a moment. So as I mentioned before, today Nick, our speaker, is going to share his predictions on how quickly the economy will bounce back from the crisis, some historical background, and importantly, how we as marketers can navigate these uncharted territories. Today, we're going to try something a wee bit different, as you know we like to at the Marketing Society. So after Nick has spoken, speaking for about 20 minutes or so, I will pop back on screen and moderate a live Q&A. So at that time, we will ask you all to come onto screen so we can see your lovely faces and we can take part in a Q&A where everyone can see each other, which will be really lovely. If you don't fancy taking part in that in a live way, you might want to hide your video. That's absolutely no problem. Then just use, as always, the Q&A function for questions and the chat function to take part in the conversation. If we can use the Q&A, that would be awesome, wherever possible. And please, as I always say, keep your questions as pithy as possible so we can get through as many as possible. But obviously there's going to be the opportunity to do that in a live way, which is going to be really fun. It's going to take a few seconds to get everyone popped up at that point, so just bear with us as we do that at that part of the webinar. So as always, let's check that the chat function is working. So tell us who you are, where you're dialing in from or zooming in from. Always sound so Luddite when I say dialing. And how you're feeling today in one word. It's sunny in London. I'm certainly feeling quite optimistic and excited. And also, this is my second to last webinar with you all. It's a really special moment. Lovely, motivated, optimistic, excited, wonderful, happy, brilliant. So we're feeling positive today. Love it. Ah, there's Craig. He is in tropical Ealing. Feeling hot. Yeah, I am in tropical Twickenham. I agree. I'm with you there, Craig. Lovely. Dubai, positive, brilliant, perfect. So I mentioned we are in for a real treat today. We did a fantastic webinar with Landor before with Thomas. And today we're joined by Nick Cooper, whose official title is Global Executive Director of Insights and Analytics. But when we were speaking before, he said to me, what I actually do is I measure things. He's got a career spanning over 35 years, working for the likes of Unilever, British Airways and Kantar Millward Brown. He, as I mentioned before, got real interest in history, a budding historian, having completed a master's in Cambridge, no less. And he's fascinated with the link between brands and money. And if that's not enough, in his spare time, Nick is a professional jazz musician and he's been gigging in London for over 20 years. So next time, Nick, we are going to get you to play a bit of jazz. But for this time, do come and join me and everyone else enjoy. And I look forward to the questions afterwards. Come join me, Nick. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Gemma. Thank you for that great introduction. Good afternoon and welcome everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here speaking with you at the Marketing Society. And as Gemma said, this is one of many webinars that the Marketing Society has hosted, getting used to the funny conditions we're living in at the moment, but making a great success of it. So I hope you will enjoy the session today. I will share my screen if I can find the right deck. Where's it gone? Okay. Where are we? Can we... Where's it gone? Can you see my presentation or not at the moment?
Not yet, Nick. It's Gemma back again.
See. Oh, that's very strange. Where's it gone? It worked last time.
This is the wonders of technology.
Yes, I don't really want to share that. So apologies. Ah, here we go. Now, this is what I want. That's it. Right. Can you see that on the screen okay? Hopefully that's come up now.
Yep, we've got it.
Brilliant. Yeah, sorry for the pause on that. Look, in these kind of extraordinary times we find ourselves in, I really wanted to take stock of where we find ourselves and try and put recent events into some kind of context and also try and understand what it all means for where we go next. And before I get into the presentation, I wanted to ask a quick polling question, which I believe Kylie will be kind enough to make work. It was a good quick question. It'd be great to get your answers, please. And the question is, do you believe we are living in unprecedented times? Yes or no? Or maybe even. I think we need to give 30 or 40 seconds for the answers to ping in. So do we believe we're living in unprecedented times? We have the results in. So we have 78% saying yes, we are in unprecedented times, 6% saying no, and 17% saying maybe. So we have 3/4 who think we are, and 1/4 who are perhaps reserving judgment. Very interesting. Well, let's just get into some of the things we want to talk about today. Thank you very much for voting on that. I think that what I wanted to talk about today was first of all to put what we're seeing in terms of COVID-19 into a bit of historical context. As Gemma said, I'm a budding historian. I did history at university. But I think I always think the starting point is history is not necessarily the best guide to the future, but it's a jolly good place to start. And when we look at what's happening with COVID, and I know we've been told that it's kind of like flu, but it isn't really like flu, it's something worse. It's very interesting to go back over the last 100 years to look at the major pandemics that we have suffered from. Most particularly the Spanish flu 100 years ago, and then the Asian flu in the 50s and Hong Kong flu in the 60s. What is interesting is that in the Spanish flu, and I know times are different then, but depending on who you read, between 20 and 50 million people died worldwide. In the Asian flu, it was about 3 million. In the Hong Kong flu, it was about 2.5 million. What we're seeing at the moment is, depending on how much we believe the statistics, we've got global cases approaching about 9 million. And we've got deaths, unfortunately, approaching about 500,000. Now, a couple of interesting things here. In the past pandemics, the infection rate was between 25 and 35%. What's interesting is that nobody really knows quite what the infection rate is for COVID. I've seen different statistics ranging up to, interestingly, about 25%, but nobody really knows yet, particularly how many people are asymptomatic. So from a pure mortality point of view, from a pure number of deaths point of view, which is a very cold way of looking at it, but we're looking at between 400,000 and 500,000 deaths so far, which, quite frankly, pales into insignificance compared to what's happened before. The worrying thing, however, is the mortality rate. In the past, flu typically kills between about 0.5 and 2.5% of those it comes into contact with. the mortality rate with COVID, which is the worrying thing, is arguably around 5%. Now, interestingly, as I was researching this, it was around 7%, and then it dropped to 6%, and now it's dropping to 5%. And it may well be that that is partly due to the way that statistics are kept, as the disease unfortunately spreads to places like Mexico and Brazil and India and Iran. But I think the worrying thing about COVID, which is absolutely fair, is that we don't quite know how virulent this thing is, because in pure numbers, we have seen this before and way, way worse than this. But the trouble is we still don't quite know what we're dealing with, which is making extremely anxiety inducing. But I think it's instructive just to look at this in the round and just to understand that what we're dealing with at the moment is of a different of order of magnitude in terms of number of deaths, but potentially a rather more serious order of magnitude in terms of mortality rate. But given that as the context, I wanted in particular to understand what the economic impact of all of this is, looking from a stock market point of view, from a GDP impact point of view, and last and not least, trying to understand what the implications might be from a brand and a marketing point of view. I think starting off with the stock market, what is interesting, again, if we go back in time to put some kind of context around it, because we hear the word unprecedented a lot. And as we saw, 78% of you feel that it's probably unprecedented. When we look at the stock market, we see that if we go back to SARS in 2003, there was a 15% negative impact on stock market prices. The dot-com bubble, which was around the same time, actually was a 45% knockback. And then we look at the Great Depression from 1929 to 1933. It was a catastrophic 80% hit on stock prices. When we look at COVID-19, we actually see a 30% decrease. So it's big, but it's far from unprecedented. What's really interesting about the impact on the stock market of COVID is two things. One is, wherever you look in the world, the impact has been almost exactly the same. Looking at the S&P 500, the FTSE 100, the DAX, the CAC, the MICEX, and so on, every stock market had declined between 27 and 33%. It's this funny band, and everything happened. And the other thing that's really weird about this is it happened incredibly quickly. When we look at the impact of these negative hits in the past, they happened over several months or over multiple years. With COVID, it all happened in a month. It all happened in 4 weeks. Between February and March this year, the stock markets fell by 30%. And what we've seen is that we saw a partial bounce back of between 10 and 15%. And then we've seen sort of broad stasis. I think that when we look at the impact on the stock market, it will probably take about 2 to 3 years to come back. And to recoup the losses from COVID, which actually in the great scheme of things is not that bad. When we look at the dot-com bubble, that took 5 years. The Great Depression took 6 years, arguably 10 years, because it wasn't really until the Second World War, unfortunately, broke out that the full impact was removed. So we've seen an incredibly sudden fall, and I think we will see a slow but steady recovery over the next 2 to 3 years. What is also interesting about what's happened in the stock market is that very unusually there have been winners as well as losers. Normally when a stock market goes wrong, everything goes wrong. But what we've seen is that there have been some very clear winners, not least grocery operators, pharmaceutical companies, many but not all CPG companies, and of course a lot of digital companies have done extremely well. Equally and oppositely, we've seen that the banking sector has been hit very hard. Automotive has been hit incredibly hard. Heavy manufacturing like Siemens has been hit very hard. Oil and gas has been severely hit. And some of you will recall the unprecedented fact that the oil price actually went negative. And we've also seen the leisure, transport and tourism industry basically evaporating before our eyes, with many major companies losing up to 98% of their business almost overnight. So I think that, you know, this kind of situation, there are some things that have been very, very strong and those that haven't. And this is actually very, very unusual. And this is also why the impact on the stock market hasn't been as severe as we've seen previously, and also why the stock market is coming back reasonably strongly and will be in a fair position, I think, over the next two to three years. So that's the stock market. So it's useful to look and compare and contrast that with what's happening with GDP, with gross domestic product. Again, we go back in time. We look at things like the Ebola crisis, which happened in 2013 and hit West Africa. That was quite severe. It was around an 8% hit that took place fairly quickly over 2 years, although it picked up again 2 years later. Pretty much all of us will be old enough to remember the financial crisis from 2008-09, where there was actually on balance a 5% impact on GDP. Some countries were less, some countries were more, up to 8%. It took about 2 years to really take effect. And then it took a long, long time to recover from that. Some economies recovered fairly quickly. Others, such as Italy, you could argue, still haven't quite recovered 10 to 12 years later. But when we look at the Great Depression, we see a 30% hit on global GDP, which happened over 4 years. And as I said, the recovery really took 10 years to take place. And the recovery was not even fully there until the Second World War broke out and obviously took up the productive capacity, not necessarily in the right way, of course, but it took up the productive capacity of economies. So in that context, we see that things like the financial crisis, which we still remember and are still quite fresh in the mind, was actually only a few percentage points. In comparison, when we look at what we're facing here, again, when we look at previous epidemics, the Spanish flu had a 5% negative impact on global GDP. The Asian flu had a minus 3% impact on those countries that were affected, and the Hong Kong flu had very little impact at all. When we look at coronavirus, we are seeing numbers that are quite staggering. We're seeing GDP impacts of between minus 10 and minus 20%. Certainly on a quarterly basis, we have Hubei province, which is where the virus started. It declined 40% in quarter one, which is, you know, in peace times virtually unprecedented. We see that the UK fell over 20% in Q2. That's the prediction. And many major economies are going to decline between sort of 10, 12, 15% this year, including the UK. So you have to go back nearly 100 years to see anything like this. Again, I think this is extraordinary because the suddenness and significance of this is almost unprecedented. Certainly the suddenness is utterly unprecedented. It's happened in the case of a few months rather than a few years, which has never been seen before. And the significance of the decline is something we basically haven't seen for about 90 years. And it's worth thinking about why this is the case. In particular, the lockdowns that have taken place, and we can, I've looked at lots of inputs from many people about why lockdowns are right and why maybe lockdowns perhaps aren't right. But certainly the lockdown on we've seen in the past regional or city or town-based lockdowns. We've never seen national lockdowns, and we've certainly never seen international lockdowns. So the government action to lock down total economies is completely unprecedented and quite extraordinary. And that clearly has had a massive impact on the economy. Equally, the government intervention we've seen is also unprecedented. We have seen the largest one-day intervention ever by the Bank of England. When it started, they poured £200 billion into the economy. and the package is £300 billion and rising. We've seen a €750 billion package from the EU. We've seen a $3 trillion package from the US. We've seen a 6 trillion ruble package from Russia. We're getting interventions which amount to about 10% of annual GDP in the space of a few weeks, which has never been seen before. And it's very interesting when we compare this to what happened in the Great Depression. During the Great Depression, government debt didn't move. Basically, governments didn't do anything. In fact, the only thing they did do was start putting up tariffs and closing trading borders, which actually made the crisis far, far, far worse and prolonged it. So we are, I think, at least seeing some kind of equal and opposite government intervention to try and ameliorate the unprecedented impact of the lockdown. So before we go on to the last chapter, implications for brand, I think it's just worth recapping quickly. So when we look at COVID-19, we see the number of deaths, quite frankly, from a statistical point of view, and I don't want to appear heartless, from a pure statistical point of view, they're very low. But the worrying thing is how lethal this thing is. When we look at the stock market, we're actually seeing quite an impact, but it's sudden and we're already recovering, and I think we'll be okay in the next 2 to 3 years. When we look at the economy as a whole, we have not seen anything like this for a long, 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 long time. And I think it will take many, many years for most economies to recover fully from the impact of this. But in the meantime, what are the implications for brand, and does it make life easier or more difficult? I think from a marketer's point of view, the key message from all this is we're in for the long haul. I think very often marketing is asked to act or react to what the company wants to do in the next 3 to 6 months. I think that really we need to set our sights over the next 3 to 6 years, which also I think means that we need to ensure that both the business strategy and the brand strategy have the right foundations to take us forward over a multiple year time frame rather than just over the next few months. And I think that may well cause some changes in behavior in some marketing departments. I also think that it will make marketing a rather more, or I should say even more, important discipline for many, many businesses. The next question, well, what's the impact on consumers? And there are lots of ways of looking at this, but one thing we did was we dug into our brand equity database called Brand Asset Valuator that has data on brand equity that extends since 1993. And we asked consumers what they value more and what they value less. And the data we picked out here is from the USA, which is a quarterly survey. So the data we have is the shift from sort of quarter four 2019, which is pre-COVID, to quarter one 2020, which is kind of in the middle of COVID. The uplifts, so what do consumers value more? In some ways it's not surprising, but they value social, progressive, intelligent and socially responsible brands. Those are the attributes that they're seeking in brands. And so in many ways, this is actually accelerating what we already knew to be true. But in many ways, it's compacting about sort of 5 or 6 years of progress in terms of consumer attitudes and concertinaing it into the space of a few months. So the things that we thought were happening anyway have been accelerated. On the right-hand side, we're saying, well, what are the biggest declines? What are the attributes that perhaps consumers are valuing less? What is interesting is that we could argue that some of those attributes are perhaps more rational, but certainly those attributes are things that characterize traditional brand leaders in a lot of markets. So leader worth more straightforward and down to earth. That consumers are actually valuing less the traditional connections that they would have found in leading brands and actually shifting their sights onto wider, more societal attributes that they want brands to represent and stand for. And I think that's quite significant. And I think that is something that is likely to stay with us, and this acceleration of this trend is likely to be a permanent fixture going forward. One other thing is kind of, what's the implication for brands in all of this? I think there are three things that really shine through. One is that if consumers are valuing more societal attributes, then I think the role of brand purpose becomes even more important. I know there have been lots of debates about brand purpose for many years, but I think this kind of solidifies purpose and embeds purpose more unambiguously than before. And I think brands that don't have a clear purpose are going to find life harder, and brands that do have a clear purpose are going to find life a little bit easier. The second thing which I find really fascinating is that there's been a rediscovery of forgotten brands. When the lockdown started, basically the only shop you could go to was a grocery retailer, okay, maybe a pharmacist. But that was about it. And there was this mad rush for tin products, frozen products, baking products, and all the things, having for many years been pointed at fresh and chill, we all suddenly rush to the long life aisles. And I think it's fascinating that many brands that perhaps we sneered at or forgot about or didn't value suddenly became really, really important in our lives. And I think that I, for one, and for those of you that are old enough to remember, I bought a Frey Bentos pie for the first time in years as part of my lockdown regimen. And I think that when we look at some of the responses to this, I think it's fascinating. Things like Heinz to Home is a perfect reaction. It may or may not work, but I think that they had to leap at that opportunity because it's a chance to sort of reconnect. Brands like, for example, Mr. Kipling, for the sake of argument, it's a chance to get back in front of many consumers, though probably haven't considered them particularly over the last few years, and to get back in front of consumers and demonstrate their worth again, which I think is, you know, really very, very interesting. And we've also seen action from companies like PepsiCo and Nestle launching direct-to-consumer operations, and even, good heavens, Nike splitting from Amazon, as I understand it. But not that they're forgotten brands, but I think there is a great opportunity for forgotten brands to get back in front of consumers. And lastly, there's a massive opportunity for challenger brands. Challenger brands obviously thrive on disruption. This kind of economic disruption hasn't happened, as I said, for 90 years. So the opportunity for challenger brands to move much faster and to move in an accelerated fashion is something that hasn't really been presented for a long, long while. And I also think that the word challenger becomes important for a lot of incumbent brands. When we look, as I say, at particularly industries like leisure, tourism and travel, those industries basically have to go back to square one. They have no business. They have to start all over again. They have to reinvent themselves all over again. They have to recreate the market. They have to recreate their category. They have to reinvent and re-engineer and reinvigorate their brands as well. So I think the challenger mindset becomes more important than ever. And that creates the route to new opportunities, both for new brands and also incumbent brands. So at that point, I'd like to thank you for your attention. I'd like to finish the presentation, go over to Q&A and invite Gemma to come back onto the screen.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Nick. That was brilliant and so insightful. And I've got so many questions, and I'm going to start asking the questions as we bring everyone else up, which the girls are doing in the background as we speak. So anyone that wants to go live, I think Kylie has put the details into the Q&A, sorry, into the chat. So you need to make sure your Zoom name includes your company name. We're going to promote you to join on the screen, so I don't believe you need to do anything. And turn your webcams on so you can take part in the conversation, but remain muted until you ask a question, just so we are able to handle it in a bigger group, because we haven't tried this before. We tried a networking connection piece, which was cool, but we haven't tried live Q&A. But as you know, we like to do things differently and keep experimenting. I'm already seeing questions coming in, but as we're promoting everybody, I'm assuming people are just going to start coming up on screen. Yeah, there we go. Oh, there we go. Carlos, how you doing? Nice to see you. You can unmute yourself whilst there's only one of you. I don't see why not. I'll break the rules. Unmute. Can you unmute?
Hi, Carlos.
There we go. Oh, Sophie, our incoming chief executive. Mark, how you doing over in St. Margaret's? I think you can unmute whilst there's a few of us. Just unmute. Why not? Now, Sophie's in Cannes right now, are you? Or Cornwall? Is that exotic?
Yeah, Nick.
Nick, how you doing? I knew you'd be here. How are you? You can unmute yourself. We'll just break the rules.
Sticking to the rules there. Very good, thank you.
Brilliant. I don't know why we're saying we need to stay muted. We can mute afterwards. And there's Lizzo. How you doing? I haven't seen you for a while. This is actually, I just love this bit, seeing everyone's faces. It's absolutely brilliant. So,
Gemma, if you untick that box, you'll see everybody that's on screen. We've got around 42 people joined us now.
That's Kylie telling me in a really polite way that I'm being a digital Luddite and I can only see about five of you. But many of you will know that from me anyway. So let me untick the box, which works for a live webinar, but not for this. Brilliant. And now I can see lots of you. How are you doing? Oh, there's Craig. Unmute yourself, Craig. Say hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. It's really good to see you and everyone else. Wonderful. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Ruth, how are you doing? Over in St. Margaret's, one of my neighbours. And Mark's neighbours as well. This is what we'll start to realise. Actually, quite a few of us live in the same area. Craig's not that far away in Tropical Ealing either.
Yeah, it's much posher here, though.
It's not really, is it?
No,
sorry. I'm in Twickenham, so they're very close.
Are you, Nick?
Yeah, I'm in Twickenham, yes.
Whereabouts in Twickenham?
Just down from the rugby ground.
Me too. We'll have that conversation offline.
Staggering to the rugby ground, yeah.
Brilliant. Lovely. So the idea is that I'll moderate this Q&A. So if you would like to ask a question, then if you can just raise your hand. Now, if you're not on my screen, Kylie and Hannah, I believe, and Rachel are going to be looking at all the other screens. So we'll let me know via chat that someone's asked a question. Answer the question. So let's just test it so I can see everyone. We raising our screen. There we go. Brilliant. Hi, Dan. Can see you too. Brilliant, brilliant. Perfect. So I'm just going to kick off, and we've already got some questions come in. But first of all, I'm really curious. You know, obviously you've really looked into the impact of COVID from a financial, from an economic, from a historical point of view. What kind of, you know, why did you look at it in so much detail, Nick? Because you really are fascinated, aren't you?
I am. Yes, it's. There were two reasons, really. I mean, I think that we all have the sense that what is happening is unusual. We can debate whether it's kind of 50% unusual or 100% unusual, but things are happening. And we live in a very sort of soundbite-sized economy or soundbite-sized society. And we always forget history for many people is kind of the end of December 2019, and it kind of stops there. So I was very interested to go back in time and actually understand the degree to which we have or haven't faced these conditions before, and to see if that could provide us any lessons, but in particular, put a context around it. And as you kind of said in the introduction, I like measuring things. Now, measuring things isn't always the answer. In fact, it's very rarely the answer. But what measuring things does is it gives you a framework to understand the kind of big strategic decisions you need to make. And I think that I heard so many things being bandied around, particularly in the media, I was started to get to the point where I actually wanted to find out for myself whether or not we are living in something that no one else has ever seen, or whether we can actually put a context around it and understand what we need to react to and what we don't. So that was really what piqued my interest in it.
Amazing. And were you surprised by any of your findings? And then I'm going to come to you next, Ruth. You've posted a question in the chat, but we're going to unmute. Well, I'd like you to unmute yourself and ask your question directly. I'm pointing to her on the screen. She won't be able to see me. The wonders of technology. But were you surprised by your findings? And then coming to Ruth.
I was surprised by several things. I mean, I have forgotten. I was surprised by the vastness of the deaths caused by the Spanish flu. And as I say, I do stress that there were different times, but you know, just scores of millions of people, tens of millions of people died. I was surprised by, in many ways, how mild the impact on the stock market was, but how all the stock markets moved together. There's a bit of a herd mentality, but I was really surprised that it wasn't worse than that. And the most surprising thing was the lockdown and the impact of the lockdown. As I say, I don't want to debate the rights and wrongs of it, but the fact is, I mean, it's an entirely voluntary move. It may be the best move we ever made, but it's entirely voluntary and has created economic conditions which are just absolutely extraordinary. The pace at which they've gone, and the fact that it's, some categories have just been almost wiped off the map, which we just haven't seen in an extraordinarily short space of time. And I was really surprised that from an economic point of view, the government actions, which most governments around the world have taken, has basically never been modelled. I looked for models on all of this. The worst model I came across was the idea of school closures. School closure sounds a bit mild, but effectively what that does is it takes out between 15 and 20% of the economic workforce. If you can't send your kids to school, it just knocks people out. And we have, that's kind of what we've done, but we've never modeled this before. Nobody has looked at this, but we took the action anyway. And I find that fascinating. As I'm not judging whether it's right or wrong, but just trying to see what kind of impact that would have. That surprised me the most, that these enormous decisions have been taken. Some of them, to be absolutely honest, with no data, because there is no data to be had. So you have to follow your judgment and hope it's right. So that number of surprising things.
Thank you, Nick. Right, I'm going to move to Ruth, who had a question. So if you want to unmute yourself, Ruth Rowan. And go. Feel free to ask your question to Nick.
Yeah, thanks, Gemma, and thank you, Nick. That was just really, really insightful, actually. So thank you for taking the time to share with us. I had a question more around if you've got any quantitative or qualitative insight on consumer attitude shift. You know, you talked about brands reconnecting to purpose, but I'm quite interested looking the other way. You know, we've all been sat at home. We've all been much closer to our own worlds. Whether there's any insight on?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think a couple of things have happened from a quantitative point of view. That where we have looked at data, we've seen, you know, consumer spend has dropped massively. But there's also been a massive and overnight shift in market share from offline to online, kind of as you would expect. Online is taking a much bigger share of a relatively smaller market. And we've studied that in markets such as Southern Europe specifically. And we've seen that very clearly. Again, we've also seen the boom in home delivery. I think from a quantitative point of view, what's fascinating is that we're working for a property company at the moment, and they're saying that their, of course, their warehouse business is going off the charts upwards, and their office space business is going off the charts downwards. And they're hoping that it will balance out. So from a quantitative point of view, consumers obviously are doing what they want to do. It's like my younger daughter works for a clothing company. Their business has been hurt very badly because why do you want lots of new clothes if you're sitting at home and not going out? But from a qualitative point of view, I do think that consumers are reassessing what they want from brands and what brands represent and what they mean. And so in particular, as well as the societal thing I pointed out earlier, I think there's an awful lot of sort of home comfort, tradition, reassurance that brands can give consumers as well. I think there is a great need that in any time of crisis, brands should be obviously more than the product. They should represent something. And I think for those consumers who want to reach out and find something that gives them some reassurance and comfort, I think those brands have done well from a qualitative perspective also.
Lovely. Carlos, I think you had a question. I saw you put your hand up.
Oh, you're on mute, Carlos.
Yep. Yeah, you're on mute. That's my favorite thing to say during the Zoom world.
No, can you hear me, right? You hear me. Hi. Yes, thank you very much, Nick. Thank you very much, Gemma. And well, I'm in Madrid and we are trying to be back to normality. And you probably know that the tourist area is responsible for 15% of the GDP of this country. And I thought very interesting comment from Nick about the need to certain industries to that have no business and or are struggling so hard to recreate the category, recreate the market. I'd like to, if it's possible, Nick, can you expand a little bit on that and specifically on what do you mean by recreate the category?
Yeah, great question, Carlos, and lovely to see you. Lovely to see you again. So the check's in the post. Thank you for the question. I think that, years ago I used to work for British Airways, so I've always been a bit of an airline fan, and I live near Heathrow, and I do some plane spotting to impress my wife occasionally on the flight path. But I think if you take airlines, for instance, what happens next? You've got this capacity issue. Every airline has had to get 75% load factors, or if you're Ryanair, it's 85%. How the hell do you get that many people on and off a plane? How do you keep them safe? How do you keep them distanced? How do you keep them fed and watered? How do you indeed process them through airports with different kinds of security? How do you test people? How do you remove the need for quarantine so that people can travel? And I think that in particular, what the hell happens to business travel? I mean, I think these things are resilient, but I mean, I think over business travel, I always think will come back, but I think it will take a long, long time. But then you have to remodel how you service your customers. You have to remodel and reconfigure how you kit out your planes. You have to reconfigure how you onboard and deboard passengers. You have to retrain your staff. I mean, it gets really quite scary. And I think you could end up, if you don't get it right, you end up with a service that in the end, either consumers don't want or they can't afford, more to the point. And therefore you have to do things in a very different way. And I think that those sorts of industries hotels are in a similar risk position. And I think that you have to relook at how you make money, and you have to relook at how you interact with your consumers, because it may be the same again. I mean, if we can find a vaccine quickly, then arguably things might go back to normal more quickly. But I do think there is, from a tourism point of view, I think people are desperate to go on holiday. I have to say, from a business point of view, business travel point of view, I'm sure more and more clients will go, Nick, we think you're really lovely, but we don't want to see you face to face this time. Let's do it on Zoom or Microsoft Teams, quite frankly. So I think that becomes a huge challenge. I mean, again, for British Airways, it's traditionally made its money from business travel. What the hell do you do over the next 5 years? It's very, very challenging. You have to do something else.
Lovely, thank you. I think we've got a question from Gail. She's put it into the chat, but I can see you there. So do you want to unmute and ask Nick a question?
Yes, hi, thank you very much, it was very insightful. Actually, I've got two questions. I'll start with the first one. I've seen quite a lot of like local businesses and side hustles like growing and like emerging during these times. What do you think? What role do you think they will play in, you know, the future of what we're going to see? Do you think, you know, it is like a really short term kind of like, you know, rise, or do you think that could be something could be in the long term, and like these SMEs will be like the future of the new economy, and you'll lose all these big companies that are around?
That's a very good question, a very interesting one. I think that when we're in the moment, we always say, I will change my ways, I will do things differently. And then over time, we gradually creep back into our old habits. But I do think your question, there are three things that will happen. I do think that the role of local stores has come back into focus. Again, there's a bit of the forgotten brands thing. I don't necessarily keep going to Tesco and Sainsbury's doing all my shopping. I'll go and, you know, get to know the guy around the corner who runs a convenience store. I think some of that will definitely stay. I think as a concomitant of that, you also then start thinking about more shopping local. I think that, walking to the shops rather than driving to the shops or cycling to the shop, I think that will become, you know, some people will lose that, but I think some people will become more embedded in that kind of habit. And I think the biggest thing which I would like to see, but I'm not sure will happen, but I think it might happen to a degree, is onshoring. So again, I think that when you, one of the things that many people, not least my family, have commented on is in the early days of lockdown, you could walk in the middle of the road. There were no cars. There were, the pollution dropped. And I think that for some people they will think harder about carbon footprints. They will think harder about locally produced rather than other side of the world produced. And I think, I would like to think that that will move the needle. There will clearly be people who are just waiting to go back to how it was, and they'll probably be able to. But I do think that the role of local business and local sourcing and local shopping will be embedded in many more people's minds, and I think we'll see a difference. It won't turn everything back to the 1950s, but it will be a noticeable difference.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for your question.
Thank you, Nick. And one of the questions that's coming in, which actually I think is a continuation of Gail's question, but from Nick. So, Nick Elliott, where are you? Do you want to ask your question?
Yes. Put in there? Thank you. Nick, thank you for all of those insights. I was just going to say that your Zoom game is excellent, so I'm afraid your air miles may well be dropping significantly in the future. that's not a question. my question was going to be that you made the point about how there are obviously a lot of losers that are existing that are out there at the moment, and there are obviously some winners, and then building on that, there was the losers are going to have to significantly change what they're doing, some more than others. So the question is, of those losers, which sectors or categories do you see bouncing back faster than others?
Very good question. I think that top of my list is financial services. I think that as the economy recovers, and I think we will see a partial rebound quite quickly, mainly because we've fallen so low, but then there'll be a kind of slow progress up the mountainside back to where we were. But I think financial services, banking and insurance will, I think, an investment will do well. Because also, I mean, that in terms of banking, whilst there's an increasing amount of competition and a lot of sort of fintech out there, some fintech has done well and some fintech hasn't, quite frankly. Their lack of financial base has been exposed. So I think the big players, the Avivas, the HSBCs, the LNGs will I think be fine. They'll do well. They'll come back quite strongly. I think somewhere in the middle, the heavy goods manufacturers, which generally doesn't trouble the UK too much, but if you think of, you know, the Hitachis and the Mitsubishis and the Siemens and the GEs of this world, I think they will get a long but slow and steady route to recovery. because in the end we'll want to consume most of what they help build. I think towards the bottom end, I think the car industry has a big question mark over it. I really do fear for the car industry that in terms of people's desire to own a car, which was obviously fading away in the younger generation anyway, will be accelerated. I think it will take a long time to come back. Things of what kind of car you want, how much you really want a car, what kind of ownership model you have will be an enormous challenge. I think, you know, the move to electric vehicles will help, but I don't think it will stop it. And then, as I say, at the bottom, I think that, that things like airlines, travel, tourism, hotels, we will see a massive shakeout because they the simply the demand will be greater than the supply and just they won't survive. So I think in that order, I think we'll roughly, we'll see financial service, I think business as usual. I think we'll see heavy manufacturing coming back over time. We'll see automotive smaller but reshaped, and we'll see travel and tourism smaller and radically reshaped.
Where do you see energy on that? So the Shells of the world.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the key thing for the requirement for energy is only going to go up. One of the ironies, of course, is that having electric vehicles actually uses more power generation than having a diesel car. So you've got to plug them in somewhere. But I think the requirement for radical restructuring is has been accelerated. I think when we look at BP and Shell, I mean, we can look at sort of peak oil between 2030 or 2040 or 2050. I think they have to get their skates on because at the moment they are, of course, exploring these areas. They are exploring them seriously and they're putting billions of dollars into them every year, but they're still putting scores of billions of dollars into oil exploration and production. And you've got to switch from $40 billion a year exploration, oil exploration budget to $5 billion. You've got to take your $5 billion clean energy budget and make that $40 billion. That's what's going to happen, and it's going to happen really fast, much faster than it would have otherwise done. So great question.
Lovely, thank you. We're running out of time as ever, so is there any other questions from anyone else? If there is, raise your hand. Oh, Lizzle, hello you. So Lizzle coming in, there we go. And if we can keep our answers quite pithy, Nick, that would be amazing.
Thanks, Gemma. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is the time at which Gemma and Craig can both roll their eyes because you know I'm going to say, what about Asia? Which is where I'm based most of the time. I wonder if you have a weather eye to that. Asia have been through MERS, SARS, bird flu. There was the Tom Yang Kum crisis, which wasn't on your chart there, but there was financial crashes there. We have different responses. There's a lot of brands working out of Asia and a lot of us work in Asia. And there's also a lot of consumers and a lot of money there. What are your general thoughts about how Asia will react to this vis-a-vis the kind of North European, North American hegemony, which is what we tend to talk about quite a lot? Whether Asia, I guess, is the question.
Whether Asia, yes. So trying to keep my answer short. Again, it will accelerate the economic shift from west to east. I think that generally speaking, we've seen the Asian economies dealing better with this crisis, or the Asian societies dealing better than the Western societies. But I think one thing is that this takes the steam out of economic growth. I think one thing that will happen in Asia is that brands will become more important because underlying growth of markets will slow down, and therefore you'll have to find something else. Rather than the rising tide that floats all boats, you're actually going to have to look harder at brand and say, how can I differentiate myself and grow my business as the category is not growing as fast as it used to be? So there's my pithy answer.
Thank you.
Lovely. That's brilliant. That was brilliant. Thank you. And that was a great question. We certainly wouldn't be rolling our eyes. That's a huge part of our community. And interestingly, Hong Kong are recovering very quickly. They've just been sending us pictures of them at a lovely restaurant that some of our members have got together, and they're boasting about how amazing the experience has been. So very much hoping we can replicate that across all of our other hubs very soon.
Thank you.